This is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on this 24th day of August, 2011. And today I am honored to be joined by Ray McGovern, a retired CIA analyst who was an intelligence briefer in the Reagan administration and one of the analysts preparing the presidential daily brief during the George H.W. Bush administration. And since retirement, he has become a tireless political activist, founding the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and delivering a famous rebuke to Donald Rumsfeld about his Iraqi WMD lies and being assaulted by security for staging a silent protest at a Hillary Clinton speech earlier this year. And his biography is just too extensive to do proper justice to here, but I am sure that the majority of the listeners out there are familiar with your work. So, Mr. McGovern, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
You're most welcome, James.
All right, well, let's start with an article that you wrote earlier this month and that's been widely disseminated online that's running under the title, Did Tenet Hide Key 9/11 Info? And it's concerning recent comments that former White House counterterrorism director Richard Clark made to a documentary film crew who are... basically, he's accusing ex-CIA director George Tenet of deliberately withholding key intelligence that could have been used to prevent 9/11. So this is a fascinating story and one that predictably, perhaps, gained almost no traction whatsoever in the establishment media. So for the benefit of the listeners out there, can you summarize the nature of the intelligence in question and Clark's accusations against Tenet?
Sure. First, a footnote, the story behind the story. It's equally interesting to me, at least, that no so-called mainstream media has put any ink into this story or let any air come up about it. It's been almost 2 weeks now. Here we have the counterterrorism czar under the Clinton and the George W. Bush White House, accusing the head of the CIA of deliberately withholding key information on 9/11 that he, Richard Clark, the counterterrorism chief, suggests with good reason could have prevented the whole thing and certainly could have prevented the hijacking of the plane that that the AA-70, American Airlines 77, that the Pentagon. So you would think that this would be a major story. Richard Clark's credibility is very high. He's never been shown to dissimulate or lie. George Tenet, the former head of the CIA, well, let's just say his reputation for credibility is not at all what Richard Clark says. He can be shown to have lied under oath, among many other times. So it's a very big story. What happened here is the mainstream media have been persuaded not to touch it. And it reminds me, if I can do another minute of diversion, it reminds me very much of the way the mainstream media handled an explosive revelation on February 24, 2003. Now, folks will remember that that's about 3 or 4 weeks before the attack on Iraq. And what did Newsweek find out? Well, they didn't just find it out. They had the document, the debriefing of the man in charge of the Iraqi biological, chemical, nuclear, and missile programs. He happened to be a son-in-law of Saddam Hussein. He defected in 1995. What did he say? He said all those programs and all those residual materials were destroyed after the war in 1991. And his debriefers, British intelligence, American intelligence, the UN, and they asked him, well, how do you know? And he said, well, fellas, I was in charge of those programs, and I ordered them all destroyed. And they said, well, yeah, well, how are you sure that they were destroyed? He said, hey, man, I went around to some of the sites. I couldn't visit them all. But look, when I make an order, they get done. They were destroyed. Now, that debriefing was purloined out of the IAEA in Vienna and given to Newsweek. And Newsweek writes this little piddly story, but it does suggest, this suggests that all this information about weapons of mass destruction may be suspect. Okay, now what happens? They call the CIA, and Bill Harlow, George Tenet's aide-de-camp, answers the phone or answers the inquiry, and he's, oh, yeah, I saw that thing in Newsweek. I just have to tell you, quote, It is incorrect, bogus, wrong, untrue, end quote. Bill Harlow, CIA spokesman, 224, 2003. So, what did the mainstream media people do? They said, well, thanks for telling us, but now we don't have to touch the story. Now, why do I raise all that? Because this is exactly what happened this time around. What Harlow, still speaking for Tenet, he's a big beneficiary of his association with Tenet, because he and George Tenet, because George doesn't know very well, split the $4 million proceeds for that bogus book that Tenet penned. So Harlow is still a very loyal guy, and what he says to the inquiry, or the people who had the guts to say, well, you know, what about this? Well, he drew out of his little card box there a whole bunch of other adjectives and epithets, talking about how this is all just made up, and that you know, there's a whole bunch of epithets not only in his remarks but in the release that he prepared for George Tenet and his two accomplices. So, what did the major media do this time? Well, thanks, Bill. Gosh. All right, I guess we'll leave this one alone. And, you know, if any observer of what happened, or any person who remembers what happened in 9/11, this is explosive information. And it leads to all kinds of new questions, because in my memory, this is the first time a very senior White House official accuses another very senior person reporting directly to George W. Bush, I mean the head of the CIA, George Tenet, accuses him of deliberately concealing information and then covering it up before the 9/11 Commission and all the other people that asked about it. So the first miracle here is it's been able to get away with it so far, not only in squashing a report that by all indications should have stop the war if the media did its job. Again, that was just 3 weeks before the attack on Iraq. But this time, stopping any legitimate questions with respect to, well, Richard Clark, what do you mean by this? How do you figure George Tenet did this? And what else do you suppose George Tenet has lied about with Bill Harlow's help? So, sorry to be doing this long digression, but this is an amazing story in terms of those who think, or those who acquiesce in the fact that they think they're getting information from the mainstream media. You won't find it in the New York Times. You won't find it in the Washington Post. Washington Post motto used to be, well, if you don't get it, you don't get it. Well, now that motto should be, well, even if you get it, you don't get it. So, sorry for the long discourse here, but the story itself is very explosive. So we have Richard Clark saying that not only, he says, you know, I used to think that there was only, let's say, one miscreant or one incompetent analyst in the CIA who kind of misplaced the information on two of the hijackers. Okay, he said, you know, these fellows, Al Mindar or Al Maidar and Al Hazmi. Yeah, we knew that they were around in the country, that there were multiple entry visas allowed and so forth. But as Clark said, and I quote, it's not what I originally thought, that one CIA analyst got this information and somehow didn't recognize the significance of it. No, he says, 50 CIA personnel knew about this, and among the 50 in CIA who knew about these guys were in the country, knew that these guys were in the country, was the CIA director, end quote, from Richard Clark. So that's big news, and I won't beat a dead horse about why it's not being treated as big news. But so Clark is saying, look, I've thought about all this, and it's, you know, really mind-boggling that Tenet would sit on this information, because, after all, we had a very close personal relationship. He followed all these matters in microscopic detail, and he told me everything except this, okay? Now, there's a normal automatic distribution for reports on terrorism. even before the CIA analysts get a whack at analyzing these things. And this has sometimes been a problem, but in cases like this, it's good for the counterterrorism czar to get the raw data, anything that was of significance. And so Clark says, you know, I was intentionally cut off the distribution, the automatic distribution of these reports on these two terrorists, and that had to be done manually by some order. And when he was asked, well, who do you suppose would be authorized to make that order, he said it would have to be the head of the CIA. So that's fact. Now, when he's asked to explain what possible motive George Tenet may have had to keep this information out of the official reporting and keep it away from the counterterrorism czar, he speculates. He says, you know, the best I've come up with is this, that these two guys had been in the country for over a year. The CIA had been terribly embarrassed by the fact that they had no human sources worth a damn on Al-Qaeda. And here they are. You know, wow. We can follow them. We can approach them. Maybe use the Saudis to get to them. We can recruit them and make them our agents, right? And then we can brag about it. Now, to do that, CIA would have had to keep that away from the FBI, because once these cats were in the U.S., they were under FBI jurisdiction, and that wouldn't work. We wouldn't want the FBI to get credit for, you know, turning these guys into counter spies if we were able to do it. So they kept it away from the FBI until the very end, until about three weeks before 2001. 9/11. 2001. So the question arises, well, why did they tell these low-level, not senior, but low-level FBI types in late August 2001? And the answer to that clearly is that the Israelis, the Russians, the French, several of our friendly intelligence services were reporting on these guys, and it just wouldn't do for the record to show that the CIA didn't tell the FBI about these folks. Obviously, the attempts to double these agents failed, and then it became very embarrassing. As Richard Clark points out, even on September 4th, when finally, after all the pleading that Clark had done, finally they had a principals meeting at the National Security Council in the White House. That means the top people chaired by the president. Even then, George Tenet concealed that information. And Clark says, why is this important? Because if it was important, because if he had revealed it, we could have stopped the hijacking, at least the hijacking of American Airlines 77. Well, how would that work? Well, he said, I would have put out an all-points bulletin. We'd put it all over the press. We would have found these, he uses a pejorative word, he says, we would have found these assholes in a day or two, and we could have wrapped them up, maybe wrapped up the whole plot. Well, there's a lot of assholes involved here. My only question is whether you hyphenate that word, But that's an aside. Here we go with the other rationale. Now, why, Clark asks himself, why would possibly Tenet, who was so embarrassed not to have told low-level FBI officials early on, but did tell them at the end of August 2001, why didn't he raise it at the National Security Council meeting? That's what the meeting was all about. They're the principals. Why didn't he mention it? And Clark says, well, that one's easy if you've worked in the bureaucracy. He says, if Tenet had said that, I would have stood up and said, well, how long have these people been in the country? And Tenet would have to tell the truth then. Oh, they've been here about more than a year. And you're just telling us about this now. And he said heads would have rolled. Heads would have had to roll. Even if George Bush was reluctant, even if he was involved in this suppression of information, with everyone there, it would have hit the fan. And so Clark says, so that's a very good bureaucratic reason why George Tenet would not give full information about these two people. rest of the story, of course, is that they were two of the five hijackers that brought down American Airlines 77. And there's lots more to the story. With respect to Tenet and Bill Harlow, his aide-de-camp there, his PR guy, well, let me just finish by saying that their record for credibility is not very good. And that, you know, even their statement where they refuted, in quotes, Clark's accusation, even that had holes in it. The interviewers had to go back to Tenet and his two accomplices and Harlow and say, look, you know, some of this is factually wrong. Maybe you ought to look at it and at least get your argument factually correct. And so they ended up putting out a second statement that corrected the factual errors. So it's really quite an amazing set of circumstances. And if Tenet gets away with this, I mean, I'll just tack on this thought. They brag in their statement that they have testified at length before several committees and groups under oath about these things. And that brought to mind Tenet and John McLaughlin, his deputy, their testimony in April 2004 before the 9/11 Commission. And one of the commissioners asked Tenet, now, what did you say to the president during the month of August 2001? And Tenet said, oh, nothing. We weren't in touch. And the questioner says, well, not at all? No. The president was, you know, Crawford, and I took a little leave. And not even by telephone? No, not by telephone or anything like that. Okay, so the plebeians go off. People go home. The evening TV programs have their take, and Bill Harlow gets in touch with the 9/11 Commission, and he says, oh, darn, oops, George Tenet misspoke. Actually saw the president twice in August. One was on the 17th of August, and one was at the very end of August, the 31st, the day after George Bush got back into town after that very long vacation. So that, for the record, we're correcting that. Well, did you see that in the mainstream media? Of course not. That simply went by the board. They decided to protect their rear ends by telling the truth. Now, even with the admission that George Tenet, as he later explains in his book with Harlow, even though George Tenet went down to Crawford, Texas on the 17th of August, what he says in his book is, you know, it was an amazing thing. It's the first time I've ever been at a presidential retreat there, and especially this one in Crawford. And I had the pleasure of being driven around by George W. Bush himself in his pickup, and we went all over. And I saw the flora and the fauna, and I said, you know, we don't have that kind of flora and fauna in Queens, where I grew up. This is amazing, and blah, blah, blah. It goes on in his book, okay? Now, before the 9/11 Commission, he forgets about that. So, then it says in his book, I went down there because I wasn't really sure that the warning we had given to the president, the president's daily brief item of August 6th, which the title of which was Al-Qaeda Determined to Strike in U.S. I, George Tenet, was not sure that they were taking it seriously enough, so I thought I ought to follow up. So, you know, 10 days later, I went down to Crawford. So that much is established. He lied under oath. He did go down to Crawford, and it was specifically to follow up on 9/11 and the warning that they had issued on the 6th. Ron Suskind, by the way, has the information that after the briefer told George Bush on August the 6th, or showed him the item that was titled Al-Qaeda Determined to Strike within in U.S., and the president dismissed it by saying, okay, well, now you covered your asses, so you're satisfied. That was the attitude, at least on the part of the president. Now, the new information that I adduce in my latest article on this is something that has been given no attention at all, even though I've published on it before. And that is, August 17, President goes down to Crawford. Now, he admits it, and he tells why he went down. He went down again a week later, August 24th. wow, the anniversary of August 24th, wow, it's exactly 10 years.
It is 10 years to the day since that happened, isn't it? And in fact, someone has uncovered online that there is, it's no longer on the White House website, but there is an archived page from the White House website that you can find on the Internet Archive that shows the press release that the White House released of George Bush, quoting George Bush, talking about his chat with George Tenet on the 24th. So it is absolutely 100% confirmed he was there.
Yeah, I was... I'm an inveterate hoarder of stuff, and I have that press release duly printed out. It was something that I just uncovered by doing a little basic research, and sure enough, here's the president bragging to the newly confirmed Joint Chiefs of Staff, including General Myers, that he took them around the spread there at Crawford. He said, "Now this is just see this flora and fauna, you know." And then he said, "You know, George Tenet was really." He was really interested in this because he was here just yesterday and we were driving up the same canyon yesterday. Well, he happened to be speaking on the 25th of August, and this is the 24th he's talking about. So the question comes up, why would George Tenet find it necessary to go back to Crawford personally a week later? And the answer, I think, comes out of the court documents that were released in conjunction with the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, the hijacker or would-be hijacker that was learning how to steer a 747, but didn't much care about learning how to land it or take it off. This is the fellow out of Minnesota that the FBI had, the FBI agents had fingered as a real, really important source and had headquarters FBI sat on it. Anyhow, he finally had his day in court, okay, here in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of Washington. And it was highly interesting because some of the documents revealed that on August 23rd, George Tenet was briefed on what was going on there in the collection effort against Al-Qaeda. And the briefing he received was terrorists learn how to fly airplanes. And they pointed out that, that Moussaoui had been fingered as connected with terrorism, and that he was just wrapped up in Minnesota, and they knew what he was trying to do. And so, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer to think that here, this is all coming down on the 23rd, the confirmation that Moussaoui was connected with Al-Qaeda. And so George Tenet said, well, I bet you have to tell the president, this is not the kind of stuff to put in writing. I go out and tell him what the latest is. That's speculation on my part, but I think it's a very good guess. So so the major point here is that George Tenet lies a lot. The minor, not so minor point is that the president was briefed on this on the 6th of October, the 6th of August in writing, and the president's daily brief, on the 17th of August, personally by George Tenet, again on the 24th, exactly 10 years ago, coincidentally, by George Tenet in Crawford, and then again on the 31st, when Bush got back from his long vacation, kind of briefed him in Washington, and then just a few days later, or like 5 days later, September the 4th, when they finally got a principals meeting, that means most senior people, meeting on Al-Qaeda and the threat. So September the 4th, if my arithmetic is right, that's 1 week before 9/11. Even on September the 4th, George Tenet withheld the key information indicating that two of the hijackers had been identified for more than a year, and that they've been followed. So he kept that suppressed for the reasons, I think, all right, the reasons that Richard Clark gave, namely, just too damn embarrassing to admit that they had these guys in their sights for over a year and didn't tell the FBI until just a few weeks before, that kind of thing. So the story is, I mean, you don't have to be a detective aficionado to like or to think the story is intriguing, but the fact that very few Americans, other other than the ones that Read Consortium News, where I publish, at Truth Out, where Jason Leopold publishes, and the Daily Beast. Phil Sheehan has some good information on this. If you, you know, if you forget those things, then you don't get it, literally, and you're blissfully unaware, as 99% of our populace is, that something really stinks with respect to 9/11. And here is unusually firsthand, senior, highest level information that somebody's lying.
Or I might humbly add, if you listen to the Corbett Report, you would also be well-versed on these types of issues. But certainly it is a fascinating story, and one that I think understandably has been neglected by the establishment media, that's well best served by keeping these types of stories out of the public eye as we approach the 10th anniversary. But I think it's important also to delineate firmly that Richard Clark's explanation for these actions of Tenet and the others at the CIA who did cover up this information is complete speculation. And while it does certainly fit with the facts as we know them within the boundaries of the context of this discussion of Al-Hazmi and Al-Maidar, it doesn't explain all of the other incredible catastrophic failures of intelligence that happened at seemingly every key juncture along the way, from the NSA deliberately withholding information from the Yemen Al-Qaeda communications hub that they were spying on for years before the CIA even found out that was going on. There's the FBI agents who were desperately trying to actually search Moussaoui's possessions, but were prevented from doing so by their higher-ups in the FBI. There's Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer talking about the DIA and their Able Danger program, which had actually identified Mohammed Atta and deliberately told agents not to go after him. There's key point at which agency after agency deliberately withheld information and deliberately stopped agents who were really quite interested in investigating further and could have exposed a lot of this beforehand. I think that, in a broader context, tends to point to a very different explanation, and it's one that's undecidable with the information in the public record at this point, but certainly it must be on the table.
Yeah, you know, there are the lines of speculation that focus on malfeasance, and there are those that focus on misfeasance. Now, maybe you have had to work in government, or the federal government, at least for 30 years to appreciate, in a real sense, how royally the bureaucracy can screw up, okay? Colleen Rowley, the famous FBI whistleblower, she and I shaked our heads about that and said, you know, people can't quite grasp how royally we can screw up in the bureaucracy and then cover it up just to cover up our own misfeasance. Now, the interesting thing about the Clark revelations is that's what he thought. Okay? That's what he says now. You know, I bought the line that there was just one CIA analyst who was misfeasing, if you will, okay? He knew about these guys, but he just didn't tell anybody. Well, now Clark says, I originally thought that, but now I know that 50 people, including the CIA director, knew about these guys floating around the country. Now, to his credit, even though there's no great substance to this, that it is speculation, and Clark is the first to admit this, to his credit, he just doesn't like, you know, the morning talk shows on Sunday. Well, I guess we'll have to leave it there. You know, leave it there. He owes us, he believes, some sort of speculation as to why. Why possibly Tenet would do this kind of thing, withholding information on these two guys. Now, if you've worked in intelligence for a long period of time, as I have, and you know how embarrassing it was for my former colleagues not to have any sources in Al-Qaeda, and these two guys show up in the United States, you want to get them. If you want them to be yours, you don't want the FBI to know they're even around, okay? You want to turn them. You want to be able to go to George Bush and say, we've got double agents. Or maybe they did go to George Bush and say, we have double agents, and next thing you know about them, they're killed in a plane crash, okay? So it's very intricate. I respect all of those who are typically called conspiracy theorists. I detest the way they are dragged over the coals and dismissed. was reported in that 11 Commission report, and that much is clear, even by statements by Governor Kaine and Lee Hamilton, the co-chairs of the commission, who said in their book, and this is a virtual quote, we were set up to fail. They didn't give us enough time. They didn't give us enough access to information. They didn't give us enough money. They didn't give us enough good people. So we were set up to fail. Well, hello. You know, that's an admission that the 9/11 report is the cover-up. So the answer to the question is, what's being covered up and why? And Clark comes to the conclusion in this particular set of circumstances that there were excellent, you know, if you put excellent in quotes, excellent bureaucratic reasons to cover this up from the perspective of George Tenet, who let these guys wander around the country for a whole year without telling the colleagues in the intelligence community, which he is duty sworn. I mean, talk about oaths. He takes an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, just like we in the military did. His job, right on the top of it, is to inform his colleagues and the other agencies of the intelligence community, given his role as coordinator of all intelligence, and that's law, okay? That's a result of Pearl Harbor, when there were all kinds of little snippets of intelligence lying around here and there, and no one coordinated it. Nobody told what was going on. So that was his job. And so it's not small potatoes for George Tenet to, I mean, he's pretty good at lying. So this is just kind of a white lie. He might have told the president, you know. I have a suspicion that he told the president about these two fellas and told the president what he was trying to do, and got the president sort of Cheney's blessing. Yeah, yeah, that's good. Don't tell anybody else. You have to see if we can get him, you know. I don't have any evidence of that, but the record of both these gentlemen, George W. Bush and George Tenet, is one that does not bear close scrutiny if you're looking for integrity.
Well, you've certainly amply demonstrated that in your article. But again, yes, I mean, Tenet might have told Bush in those meetings that he later denied having in front of the 9/11 Commission. But we really don't know. And again, that's speculation. But it seems to me that in this case, when we have this absolute evidence of cover up, we have the two alternatives: cover up of misfeasance or malfeasance, cover up of accidental something that went wrong, or cover up of something that deliberately went wrong. And really, at this point, it's undecidable, I would say, and I don't see how it would be in the public's interest to eliminate one of those options until we have the actual background and we have this explored in an appropriate way by the various institutions, not just media, but judges, courts, government, independent investigations. I don't see why we would close those options until we have the information that would make that decidable.
Yeah, James, please don't misunderstand. I agree completely. How you come down on either of those options is a matter of experience, speculation, and access to information. And I'd be the first to admit that I have not busied myself to the extent I ordinarily would on this because of all the good work that's being done by so many 9/11 researchers. Now, people say to me, now, come on, Ray, for God's sake, don't you believe Dick Cheney is capable of all this? And I say, oh, yeah, sure. So I believe that. Well, what's wrong with you, McGovern? And I say, well, I don't do faith-based intelligence, okay? I do empirical analysis. And until I see a credible narrative laid out that is far better than the 9/11 Commission cover-up, you know, I just applaud those who keep doing the work, but I can't really say that my belief that Dick Cheney is capable of this, or George Bush and George Tenet, that really matters in terms of the way I approach intelligence, because, in a word, I don't do faith-based intelligence. Now, that's with all due respect to many of my friends who are into this big time, and I have put myself out there. I've chaired two meetings, one in Berkeley, one in Boston, of the architects and engineers and others who are involved in this. I applaud them. All I can say right now is that with this latest information, they should be given a real fillip here, a real kind of boost to explore some of the other lies that have been told. How it all went down, I just don't know. I have very serious questions, some of them arising from personal experience. I don't know if you have another minute, but Secretary of Transportation Mineta, okay? Now, he was with Dick Cheney in the bunker when all this went down, okay? In the bunker in the White House. And his account of what happened varies markedly from what ended up in the 9/11 Commission report. At one point, he's sitting with Cheney, and this young man comes in, and he says, Mr. Vice President, 5 minutes out now. Same orders? And Cheney looks at him and says, yes, same orders. Comes in 3 minutes later. Mr. President, just 3 minutes out, same orders? Yes, does anybody change the orders? No. Okay. So the guy goes away, and 3 minutes later, submits the Pentagon. And then, of course, an hour later, the plane goes down in Pennsylvania. Now, why do I mention all this? Because Secretary Mineta and I were reading parts of the Constitution on Constitution Day at a fancy place in Georgetown University about 5-6 years ago. And after I finished, I had amendment number 12 or something, and Mineta had amendment 23 or something. And I said, you know, if I had any guts, I'd find out where the speakers come out from, and I'd position myself there, and I'd get Mineta and I'd ask him some questions. And then I'm sitting there saying, well, should I really do this? I mean, this is not the right occasion. And I thought, yeah, what would those gutsy women from Code Pink? What would Cindy Sheehan do? Would she be having this debate in her own head about whether she should give me a break, McGovern? What kind of a wuss are you? So I found out where they come out. And this is great big palatial, looks something like out of Versailles. There's this big hall. So I set myself to one end of it, and there comes Mineta in the company of a young Georgetown co-ed. And so I said, Secretary Mineta, Ray McGovern. Now, he didn't know me from Adam. I never met the man. But in Washington, you never admit that you might have forgotten. Somebody says, oh, Ray, well, how are you? I said, can I ask you a couple questions? Yeah, sure. The colleague goes away, and I say, Secretary, you know, there's a lot of speculation about what happened in the bunker there when you were with Dick Cheney, and that young man came in and said all those things. Well, he started to get very afraid, really, is the best description. And I said, look, the only question I want to ask you is, was that young man, was he in uniform? He said, no, he wasn't in uniform. I said, oh, well, follow up. Who was he? Do you know who was? I never asked about that. I said, well, Secretary Mineta, how about the substantive issue? You know, right before the plane hits the Pentagon this morning, and he turned ashen. And he looked at me and he said, you know, that we worried about that plane over Shanksville there in Pennsylvania. We worried. I said, no, Secretary Mineta, that's an hour later. I'm talking about, you know, 9:30 when you were with Cheney and all this happens. You know, how do you figure it out? Was there a stand down order or something? Or what was the order that would not be reversed? He said, well, you know, Pennsylvania was the focus on him. And he kept going back as though he had talking points. Do not say stand down. Say only shoot down. And, of course, the big issue that he tried to divert my attention with was the shoot down. Was a plane shot down over Pennsylvania or not? Because there was a big controversy about that at the time. So after about, I kid you not, it was about 6 or 7 minutes of this, and all I'm getting is this blank stare, and all I'm getting is Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania. I said, well, it's nice talking to you. And then we left, and by coincidence, I was flying out to California the next day. And where do I land? I land at the Carl Mineta Airport in San Jose. So, you keep your mouth shut, hey, you get an airport named after you. You cooperate fully, and you get a Medal of Freedom like George Tenet.
Yes, and yet without Right. And yet without Mineta's testimony, we would never have known about that at all. But certainly that has there has been a concerted effort to try to keep people's attention diverted from that. But a couple of points on that testimony. First of all, there was a member of the 9/11 research community who did actually identify the person who was actually giving those status updates to Cheney in the bunker. And it was identified by name. I don't have the name off the top of my head here, but it is online. And there was a conversation that the person managed to post of him phoning this person who I believe is still in active duty for the U.S. military. And that was a fascinating conversation, but basically he just confirmed that that whatever the 9/11 Commission report said is true. So there was not much new information that came from that, but it was a fascinating little tidbit. And secondly, the thing that really amazed me about the Mineta testimony, probably more than anything, or not really surprised, I'm not really surprised, I suppose, but back in 2007, 911truthseattle.org actually met up with Norm Mineta at a speaking engagement that he was at. And they confronted him with the fact that that he had testified that Cheney was in the bunker when he had arrived, and yet the 9/11 Commission report places Cheney's arrival at 9:58, which is a huge discrepancy, obviously, and of course is the difference between Cheney being in the bunker for Flight 77 and not being in the bunker. So obviously a huge point. And when confronted with the fact that the 9/11 Commission report had actually placed Cheney in the bunker at 9:58, not 9:20, as Mineta had said, he seemed genuinely surprised at that fact. Which points to me the fact that Norm Mineta did not read the 9/11 Commission report and that the media has never followed up on that discrepancy, which is, in both points, pretty unfathomable.
Yeah. Well, you know, I met him once, right? And he had an axe to grind in trying not to appear very bright, but he did, in reality, seem to be, not the brightest star in the heavens, you know? And you get a guy like this, you make him Secretary of Transportation, and you got exactly the right guy in place to do whatever your bidding is. Now, you know, they were in charge of the Federal Aviation, the FAA, which had purview over the airports and the airplanes and so forth, and really were in the pocket of the large airline companies. And one of the sidelights here, which is highly interesting, is that Bogdan Zakovic, who's still working in government, so he's reluctant to say more, he has said let me just tell you what his job was. He was head of the secret detachment of FAA marshals that was tasked with trying to penetrate planes and airports to see if terrorists could get on planes. And he reported to the FAA authorities 9 out of 10 times his team was able to penetrate airport security and get on the plane, okay? He couldn't get anybody to listen to him. He was shoved aside to put paperclips in their boxes, okay? Now, we asked him after WikiLeaks exploded, after WikiLeaks had a lot of information, a lot of things, we said, Bogdan, if WikiLeaks were around before 9/11, and you, having been frustrated after months of trying to get the word out that these planes were very vulnerable, and not even being able to persuade the FAA to put locks on the cockpits, for God's sake, like Israel's been doing since for two decades now. It costs $195 to put a lock on a cockpit, for God's sake. Not even that was the FAA willing to say, pretty please, American Airlines, pretty please, United, could you please? Actually, we'll give you the money. Please put the locks on the cockpit, okay? So what am I saying? I'm saying that Mineta is sitting over all this stuff, okay? And they just tell him, I suppose, look, don't worry about it. We got it under control. Tell those FAA guys if they want to get promoted, don't listen to the screwball Bogdan Zakovic. And he would have been able to find some way of getting this information out had there been a Julian Assange and WikiLeaks bill about the time.
And yet there's been Crypto.org since 1996, which has been doing essentially exactly what WikiLeaks has been doing since 5 years before 9/11. So I always wonder why WikiLeaks gets the attention as if it's the only such website.
Well, you're right. Somebody like me will tend to emphasize the one most in the news. But, don't take my word for all this. Colleen Rowley, the FBI person, lawyer, Minnesota, and Bogdan Zakovic, co-authored an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, which is very, very exciting reading. People can go to it. His name is spelled D as in dog, Z-A-K-O-V-I-C as in Charlie, and Colleen Lowry, we know. So all I'm saying here is that a guy like Sokolovich, a professional, a U.S. Marshal, okay, with many, many years of experience, was totally frustrated. And how did that happen? And it happens by getting a guy like Carl Manetta, North Manetta, I guess it is, at the top, and the word comes down, the White House didn't want any of that pursuits. And now that, I caution to add, that's not fact-based, that's speculation on my part. I like to distinguish between what I deduce as facts, what I'm pretty sure of, and what I'm very sure of, and speculation.
Absolutely. Well, always an important distinction to make. But yes, once again, it pains me to hear that if only there had been a WikiLeaks before 9/11, when there in fact was. I just wish more people had knew about sites like Cryptome.org. But that's another issue for another day. And I really could talk with you for a long time about these subjects. It's absolutely fascinating to me. But I know
Let me just add, you know, it's picture Sokolovich, right? Now, he's fighting this good fight, getting shunted aside, totally absorbed in this whole thing, because, as he said, I knew it was going to go down. I knew something really bad was going to happen. Now, the media is mostly at fault here, because you mentioned Cryptonome. Now, I think I heard about that, but if it's not in the news, you can't really expect someone like Sokolovich to know that he could go there. Now, WikiLeaks is so much in the news that he knew that. So all this is readily explainable by the fact that the fawning corporate media, is what I call the mainstream media, is able to suppress even information about websites where you can get the truth. So it's a really insidious development here. And what I tell people in Washington is that I've been around for 48 years now, seen a lot of change. Biggest change by far in significance, in importance, is the fact that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media, and that is big.
That is so indescribably important. I mean, as you know, obviously, from your experience, the people perish for lack of knowledge, and without an independent and truly antagonistic media that will really actually do the investigative reporting, we are really lost as a society, I think. But again, I know you're a busy man, so you don't have much time, but I think I'd be remiss in my duties if I didn't call upon your experience to ask about your thoughts about what we've seen unfolding in Libya the last few days, just some remarkable scenes coming out of there.
Yeah, well, I'd like to take a step back and just comment on the background of Libya. First off, the most important thing, of course, is that if Libya's main export were watermelons, there'd be no intervention in Libya. The oil is the play is the deal. The oil is the deal here. Sure, it's only 2% of the oil in world trade, but that 2% is golden because it's so pure that it's very, very easily refined. And Italy depends on oil from Libya for most of its oil needs, and a lot of needs there in Western Europe are satisfied by Libyan oil. So, you know, why is NATO in the lead here? NATO, the defense organization that we set up to defend against the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union. Why is it still in being, and why is it involved in Libya? Well, short answer is oil, okay? What else? I think one thing that has been completely overlooked in all this is that before this went down, and before anything was decided as to how to intervene or what role the U.S. would be in the intervention, James Clapper, who I've never been a fan of, but is now Director of National Intelligence, testified before some important committees in Washington. In an open testimony, he said, look, if you think that Gaddafi's forces can be easily overcome, forget it. He's by far the most important and the most powerful person and group there in Libya. And so, you know, just be aware of that. Well, what happened? mainstream media claimed all over Klepper. So what are you saying that for? What are you doing? You know, I mean, like, could the explanation be that he was telling them the truth? And now he can argue as to whether he should have said that in open session, but he said it. And guess what? He was right. Look at it all it's taken. It was supposed to take just days, not weeks. Give me a break. Was it 4 or 5 months or so now? So all I'm saying is that when the administration, whether it's the Bush or the Obama administration, doesn't like the intelligence that it's getting, it not only disregards it, but it sets its media dogs to ridiculing the people who say these things. Klepper was right on, and the thing is not over in Libya yet. And the fact that Gaddafi still has a coterie of armed folks with probably significant tanks and so forth, you know, that was a reality. And what we've seen play out over the last several months is not only a fiasco militarily, but it's a fiasco from our constitutional point of government, because presidents should not be allowed to start or to participate in starting wars without congressional approval. And that's precisely what happened here, and that's not a small point. There are other things that will be coming down the line now. Every precedent set that the Congress acquiesces in and says, well, okay, well, you know, if you really have to do that, then just do it. You know, it's going to come down really hard in the Middle East now, because Israel is in a situation that is much more precarious for it strategically, having lost key allies in Egypt and Turkey, and having to face what until just this past week has been a concerted effort to mount nonviolent protest, civil disobedience on the part of the Palestinians. The Israelis don't know how to handle that. And I look at the situation as being much more volatile, and you won't see that in the press, but it's the reality. And why I'm mentioning it, this connection, because if Israel strikes out at Iran or does something very stupid like that, guess who will be in there? Guess who will be in there with both feet? It'll be Barack Obama, because he wants to win an election and doesn't think that he can do that without the full support of the folks in AIPAC, the Israeli lobby organization that not only funds many of the people that will be running, but also supports Israel 100%.
Absolutely, as does the fawning corporate media, which has been boosters for this intervention in Libya since day one. So absolutely, extremely important point. So just in closing, then, do you see that this being a springboard for a similar type of unfolding of events in Syria?
Well, you know, that seemed so far-fetched a month ago. What can one confidently rule out now with this administration being so knee-jerkedly at the disposal of the far-right government in Israel? You can't rule anything out. I mean, if you probably know that I was on the U.S. boat to Gaza, which only got about 10 miles out of the port of Piraeus, Greece. Now, the reason for that was that Obama was deathly afraid that not Ray McGovern, but Alice Walker and some of the New York Times and AP and CBS correspondents, that we would get subjected to the same tender administrations that killed those 8 Turks and 1 U.S. citizen a year ago. And Obama was not able to persuade Netanyahu to please don't do that again. And so, you know what he ended up doing? He ended up leaning all over the Greek government, please, please don't let those boats get out of Greek ports. And the Greek government said, oh, you know, we're a seafaring nation. That would be so much not in keeping with. Look, you need another bailout, right? You need the IMF to come in and bail you out. Guess who runs the IMF? We do. Now, this at least you can do to prepare the conditions so that we look on this favorably. Don't let those boats leave port. So we left anyway, and we turned around by the Greek Coast Guard with commandos all suited up in the typical black, just like the ones that landed on the Mavi Marmara, and we brought back to court. Our boat was impounded. And why? Well, because Obama couldn't be confident that if he asked Netanyahu, please don't shoot up Alice Walker, that Netanyahu would do anything different from what he did the year before. That's how servile our president is, and that's how little influence he has witnessed the settlements and the whole cold question of these things. That's how little influence he has with Israel, even though $3 billion of your tax money and mine go to the state of Israel every year.
Absolutely, and it's not something that seems like it would be going to change under any foreseeable circumstances anytime soon, unless there's a fundamental shakeup of Washington, which again does not seem likely. There are very, very few potential presidential candidates other than Ron Paul that I can think of that would be advocating the stopping of such military aid to...
James, we're going to change all that starting on October 6th. We're having our own Tahrir Square and our Freedom Plaza in Washington. And I would urge all your listeners to join us. 5,000 have already signed up. We're going to be there. We're going to do our Tahrir Square. And we're not going to leave until Americans know that 58 cents out of every dollar they pay in taxes goes to discretionary funding for the military. 58 cents out of one, each dollar. Now, the money's there, folks. You know, you don't have to fire your teachers and your police officers. You don't have to do all these stringent things. All you have to do is cut back on defense spending, because there's no real reason for it. The Soviet Union, by the way, has imploded. There's no threat out there to us. All we're trying to do is get in a position to protect oil supplies, gas supplies, and be in a strategic position with our permanent military bases in Iraq and Afghanistan to, quote, protect our interests, quote, lest the Chinese, the Indians, the Russians, the Pakistanis get undue, in our view, influence over the disposition of these very important natural resources of the world.
Well, that's exciting. Tell us more about the rally.
Well, it's being organized by a coalition of very, very good people. If you go online, it's October 2011.org, and you get lots of information about who signed up already, what is being planned, and we in the Washington area are throwing open our homes and trying to be as helpful as we can for those who might be a little too old or too sick to stay in the tents. It's just going to be a really, really good opportunity for us to say, look, Obama, there's a different way of doing things. And if the young women in Cairo, and it was young women that started the assemblage on Tahrir Square, if they can do that in Cairo, surely we're not so cynical, surely we're not so uncaring about what happens to our country that we can't do it in Washington.
Excellent. Well, that is exciting, so I certainly hope people will check that out. Again, that's October2011.org?
Yes, and it starts on October 6th, which happens to be the 10th anniversary of our attack on Afghanistan, and it ends when we say it ends.
Interesting. All right, very good. So October2011.org, I hope people will check that out, and obviously people can go to Consortium News for more of Ray McGovern's articles. So once again, I know you're a busy man. Thank you so much for taking your time to talk with us today, and I hope we can talk again in the future.
You're most welcome, James.